Oregon. I'll tell you which state is considering passing an assisted suicide law.
That's today, beginning at 3 on The Bottom Line with Roger Marsh.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, this station, or its sponsors.
And here we are again. I got the microphone where it belongs now, I think. Welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are live. That's why we have faux pas, like a microphone being in the wrong place and the opening words and so forth. We just do that so you'll know it really is live. No one would really leave that in if it was pre-recorded and edited. So this is unedited and, in real time conversation between me and... Well, who? Maybe you. We've got lines open. You can call. You can participate in the conversation. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, you can call me here. We can talk about them. If you have a difference of opinion, you can call me here and we can talk about that too. One thing I should let you know is the program is very short. It ends in a half hour, which is, you're going to just turn around and say, what? A half hour has gone by already? It's really true. The show is so interesting that it just seems to go by like a flash, I know. But the reason I say that is right now our lines are open, and if you want to call at this time, you will get on before the program ends. If you call later in the program, you might, but probably won't. So I'm just saying, you want to call in, you have a question or a comment, feel free to call me. The number is this, 1-800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. 5278. I have a question here from Travis in San Diego, who may be listening because he's written in a number of questions. In fact, I may have even taken this question previously. I don't know. He says, do you know of any reason for the redundancy in the Bible? In comparing Leviticus with Deuteronomy, the books of Samuel and Kings with the books of Chronicles, there were times when I felt I was reading almost word for word what was written in the previous books. Can you tell me why this redundancy is necessary? Well, you know, if the Bible was written by a certain author who wanted to just tell the whole story, it would not seem very appropriate for him to tell some of the stories over and over again. There are some stories that are told three times, almost verbatim. For example, the story of the invasion, Sennacherib's invasion of Jerusalem in the days of Hezekiah is found in detail in the book of Isaiah. It's also found in detail in the book of 2 Kings and also in 2 Chronicles. Same story, mostly the same details. Now, why is that? The reason for that is that these are different authors. Each one is working independently of the other, although they may have some written sources that they all, use as sources, which would account for why the details may be the same. But, for example, Jeremiah was not aware that the book of Chronicles was going to be written later. And include the same material. But each writer is covering the material that they believe they need to cover. Now, if you read, if you go to a library and get, 66 books of American history, you're going to find a lot of the same stories in several of the books because these are different historians writing about American history. The books of the Bible are, in many cases, history books, written by different historians, and they're covering the same period of history. If you say, well, why are they all in the Bible? That's redundant. Well, they're all in the Bible because they were inspired writers, because each one had certain features that were not included by the others that were worth having, but it wasn't worth cutting out the parts that were duplicates. After all, when you read the first three Gospels, you definitely see a lot of parallels. Once you've read Matthew and start reading Mark, you start to think, well, I remember I read something like this in Matthew. By the time you get to Luke, you're hardly finding anything new at all. That's because three independent writers were writing on the same historical story. They don't include all the same information as each other, as no two historians will, but they don't, they are talking about the same story after all, so there's going to be overlap. So that's why there's redundancy in the Bible. Now, as far as Leviticus and Deuteronomy, both are written by Moses, but they were written 40 years apart to different generations. Leviticus was written at the beginning of the wilderness wanderings, and Deuteronomy was Moses' sermons at the end to the next generation. So he ended up reminding them of many of the same laws that their ancestors had been given at Mount Sinai in Leviticus. So even though we have the same author, we have different audiences, and so some things bear repeating, even to the same audience. So that would be why you do find these parallels and what we might call redundancies in the Bible. Sometimes the same story is told multiple times, but not by the same author, usually by different authors in different contexts or for their own purposes. All right, let's talk to Vicki from somewhere. The question she has is related to 2 Thessalonians, I'm told. Vicki, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. I'm hitting the button for Vicki's call, and it's not operating. I don't know what the problem is with my computer. Dave, could you activate that call for me? Something's wrong with my computer. It's not activating. We do have apparently a momentary. Okay, it looks like it may work this time. Let me try it again. No, it didn't. Oh, yeah, there we go. Vicki, we finally have the machines working. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. My question is from 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. It has to do with verse 6. And I'm just wondering who you think the restrainer is that is holding back the one of lawlessness. And because I'm driving, if you have any questions, I'd like to hang up after you ask any questions of me.
I think I know. I think your question is clear. I don't need to cross-examine you. Feel free to put your hands on the wheel now and your eyes on the road.
Thank you.
Thanks, Vicki. Bye now.
Bye.
Well, for those who may not be familiar, and that would be people who've never paid any attention to Bible prophecy, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 is the passage that talks about the man of lawlessness. Many Bible teachers identify this man of lawlessness with the future Antichrist. They would say it's the same individual that is referred to as the beast in Revelation 13, or as the Antichrist in 1 John chapter 2, or by some other names, a little horn in Daniel, and so forth. Well, I don't think all of these are the same person, but I do think that the man of sin may very well be a reference to the little horn in Daniel chapter 7. And the little horn in Daniel 7 would rise, it says, after the fall of Rome. What Daniel 7 does is it depicts four empires coming in rapid succession. Well, maybe not so rapid, but one right after another. And they are the Babylonian, the Media-Persian, the Grecian, and the Roman empires. And then when that's the fourth beast is the Roman Empire. Then when the beast is killed, when Rome burns, we see a continuing rule of something that grew out of the Roman Empire. It's a little horn that grew out of that beast. And that little horn is given a great mouth, boasting great things, and so forth. Now, it is believed, it was believed by most people in church history, that the little horn that would grow out of the Roman Empire is a power that would seize control in Europe in place of the Roman Empire upon the fall of the Roman Empire. This seemed to be the most straightforward interpretation of Daniel chapter 7. For that reason, the church fathers, when they wrote about that passage in Daniel, and which they believed was the same subject matter in 2 Thessalonians 2, they believe that Paul was talking about a power that would rise out of Rome, in the West, in Europe, subsequent to the fall of the Roman Empire. That the fall of the empire would create a vacuum that would allow this little horn, or this man of lawlessness, to come to power. Now, whether this is true or not is debatable. But one thing that can be said for it is all the church fathers believed this. At least all the ones who wrote about 2 Thessalonians, and there were several. And so they believed that when Rome would fall, which we know it has now, it fell back in the 5th century, but the church fathers writing before that time
believed that when Rome would fall, then this man of sin, or this little horn, would rise up. Now, something, therefore, would be restraining it, and that is the Roman Empire. Now, the Reformers, and not even just the Reformers, but even before the Reformation, many of the Roman Catholic thinkers, like the Franciscan order and so forth, believed that, in fact, Rome had, of course, fallen, and that the man of sin had risen. They believed that the institution of the papacy was the man of sin. Now, again, whether this is right or wrong, this was historically what they thought. If you read the dedication to King James at the beginning of the King James Version of the Bible, you'll find that the translators credit King James, who had, frankly, returned England back to Protestantism after it had been Roman Catholic. They credited him with having overcome the man of sin, which, is, of course, is a reference to 1 Thessalonians 2. And what they mean is, of course, that he had overthrown the influence of the papacy in England. Now, there were some pretty hard feelings between the papacy and the Protestant Reformation in those first centuries after the Reformation. And so they used very unguarded speech. These days we don't usually speak so unkindly about people we disagree with, but nonetheless, it was universally held among the Reformers and even by some Catholics before them that the papacy, its rise, was the rise of the men of sin. Now, the view of the Church Fathers on this passage, therefore, is as follows. Paul is writing to the Thessalonians shortly after he was kicked out of the city. We read this in Acts chapter 17. Paul was kicked out of the city of Thessalonica because the people there who rejected the gospel said that he was preaching things that were unlawful for them as followers of Caesar. It was unlawful for them to acknowledge another king, one Jesus, it says. So they kicked him out of the city. But shortly after that, he wrote back to the city. He wrote to the church, not the city, but the church in the city. And he wrote these words. Now, he says, remember when I was with you, I told you these things. So he had talked about this presently with them, and he was not going to say everything in writing that he had said to them in person. And he says, you know what it is that hinders this rise of this man of sin. And that which hinders will hinder until it is taken out of the way. And then the man of sin will rise. So all the church fathers, when they exegeted this passage, believed that Paul was alluding to the Roman Empire as that which would, which was currently preventing the rise of the man of sin, whatever that would be. Because the church fathers who lived before the fall of the Roman Empire did not have much to go on as to what would replace it. But they did believe this man of sin that Paul referred to refers to something that would rise in place of the Roman Empire, and that the presence of the emperors in Rome was what was hindering the rise of the man of sin. But he said, when that which is taken out of the way, then he'll rise. And so why would he be so vague about it? Well, they said, because if Paul was in fact referring to the removal of the Roman Empire, that would sound seditious. That would sound like, he's predicting the fall of Rome. And after all, he'd even been kicked out of that city, accused of saying things that were against the Roman authority. And so if this letter would fall into the wrong hands, and hostile people would say, well, listen, we have a letter from Paul here. He's even suggesting the fall of the Roman Empire. He is an enemy of Rome, after all. Some feel that Paul was guarding his words. Now, a more popular view today, which is that of the dispensationalists, is that what was hindering the rise of the man of sin is the presence of the church in the world, or possibly the Holy Spirit in the church. Some say the Holy Spirit, some say the church. In any case, it is the belief of the dispensationalists that the church, at some time in the future, is going to be removed from the world in the rapture. And the result will be that then the man of sin will be free to rise to power. And so they feel that what is hindering the rise of the man of sin is something that is still future to be removed, and that's the church. And that the man of sin is an individual who will rise after the church is gone in the tribulation period. This is the dispensational view. Now, I just want to say that there is a serious problem with that particular view, because just before Paul talks about the man of sin in this way, in the beginning of the chapter, he rules out the possibility that the church has to be removed before the man of sin can rise. Because in the opening of the chapter, it says, now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him, okay, the second coming of Christ and our being gathered to him, the rapture, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled either by spirit or by word or by letter, as from us, as though the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. Now, we don't have to read any further to see that Paul said that the rapture of the church cannot occur until two other things happen, the falling away and the rise of the man of sin. Paul says that the coming of the Lord and our gathering together into him cannot happen until these things happen. So Paul clearly places the rise of the man of sin earlier, chronologically, than the rapture of the church. And therefore, when he speaks vaguely a few verses later about something is hindering the rise of the man of sin and will be taken out of the way, and then he'll rise, whatever he's referring to, it can't be the church, and it can't be the Holy Spirit of the church, because he's already said only two or three verses earlier that the rise of the man of sin must come before the church is taken. So, and that's stated in plain words. When Paul speaks more vaguely about something, you know what it is, he says, but... well, maybe they did, but we don't. Then it'd be very strange to interpret the vague language in such a way as to contradict the plain language. That's not really the way biblical studies is generally done by responsible students. So I think there's something to be objected to in the dispensational view of this. And I think the Reformed view actually has more in its favor as far as evidence is concerned. I don't have a firm commitment about it, because after all, Paul doesn't say what it is he's talking about. And since he doesn't say, any theory we might give would have to have a certain tentativeness attached to it. But it seems to me, as I look at the evidence for the view held by the Reformers, and the Church Fathers, by the way, who all agreed on this, on the one hand, and the view of the dispensationalists, on the other hand, I would say the older view, the view of the Church Fathers and the Reformers, appears to fit the passage better than the dispensational view. But since there is a certain amount of uncertainty in Paul's wording, that is, in how to interpret it, we would have to leave that to each person to make up his own mind for sure. I hope that's helpful, Vicki, though it doesn't answer the question plainly for you. I can't answer it because Paul isn't plain enough about it for me. Let's talk to Jane from California. Jane, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Before I ask my question, could you tell me what passage you just read, what book that was in, and what verse?
Second Thessalonians chapter 2, and the last verses I read were the first three in the chapter, which tell us that the coming of the Lord and our gathering together to him cannot occur until there's a great falling away and the man of sin is revealed.
Okay.
Then the later verses are what we started out on, which talks about the man of sin in verses 4 through 10, really. And specifically in verses 6 and 7, it talks about something is hindering the rise of the man of sin. So that's what the original question asked about. What was that?
I'm going to go back and look at that. So earlier you had a question from Travis, and that prompted me to think of something. How did the Church Fathers select the books of the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament? How did they become authoritative, or canonized, I guess is the correct word?
Right. Well, the Old Testament canon was determined by the Jews before the Christians came along. And the Christians just accepted the Old Testament canon. Now, the Church Fathers actually accepted some of the books that were not even in the Jewish canon. The Church Fathers seem to accept the books we call the Apocrypha, which are today found in the Catholic Bible, but not generally in Protestant Bibles. But the Apocryphal books were recognized by the Church Fathers as somehow worth quoting, somehow, you know, authoritative to appeal to. And therefore, the Roman Catholic Church, based on the fact that the Church Fathers quoted from the Apocrypha, believed that they should be included in the Old Testament. The truth is, though, that the Jews didn't include the Apocryphal books in their New Testament in the first century. We know that because Josephus, who is a Jew living in Jerusalem, and Philo, another Jew living in Alexandria, Egypt, they basically told in their writings what books the Jews accept, and they were the same 39 books that Protestants accept. And Jesus also never quoted from, nor did the apostles, from the apocryphal books as authoritative. So we first read those books being quoted as authoritative by church fathers in the second, third centuries. So why the church fathers accepted them, I'm not really sure. But we have no evidence that Jesus or the apostles did, or that the Jews did. So the Protestant Bible, in leaving out the apocryphal books, is basically adopting the Jewish canon of the Old Testament. And whereas some of the church fathers, who were still even undecided about which books belong in the New Testament at that time, they were inclined to accept the apocryphal books. So, but that acceptance of the apocryphal books by them obviously occurred at a time when the whole canon of the New Testament was not even determined, and so there was a lot of uncertainty about certain books. For the most part, though, the books that I have in my Old Testament are the same books that the Jews have in their Bible, the Tanakh. And that those books were decided on before there were Christians on the earth to create canons and so forth. Now, the New Testament canon is based on the assumption that the authors have apostolic authority. That is, the authors either were themselves among the apostles or else chief associates of the apostles. For example, Jude is not known to have been an apostle, but he was a brother of James, and James was an apostle. Luke and Mark were not apostles, as far as we know, not in the same sense that the other apostles were, but Luke and Mark were very, very close associates of Peter and Paul, or vice versa, Paul and Peter, respectively, and worked under their oversight. And therefore, it is assumed that what Luke and Mark wrote about Christ and about the apostles and so forth has come to us with the approval of both Paul and Peter, who are apostles. So the idea of accepting a book in the canon of the New Testament was that we want to know that we have books that are really carrying the authority of the apostles, whether the apostles wrote them or merely approved of them because they were written under their oversight. And the apostles, as God's appointed leaders of the church, would have the right to pass down authoritative teaching and instruction and commands for the church. And so the church wanted to retain everything the apostles or their close associates wrote. And really, the process of putting the New Testament together was a process of progressively becoming persuaded that certain books really were apostolic. Now, it wasn't that big of a challenge because there were really only about four or five books out of the 27 in the New Testament that were ever seriously questioned. You know, all the Gospels were accepted long before the canon of Scripture was settled. For example, the final canon of the New Testament wasn't really settled until 397 of the Council of Carthage, but much earlier, in 170 A.D., Irenaeus mentioned the four Gospels that we have in our Bible and said these are the only four Gospels that are universally accepted by all Christians worldwide. So, in other words, there was no question as to which Gospels belonged in there. And the book of Acts was accepted because it was written by the same author as the Gospel of Luke and under Paul's leadership. Now, as far as epistles go, which is what most of the rest of the New Testament is, most of Paul's epistles were not questioned at all. Peter's first epistle was not questioned. His second epistle was. There was some question as to whether Peter really wrote 2 Peter. There was some question as to who had written Hebrews, because it was written anonymously. There was some question about whether Jude's book should be included, since his apostolic credentials were not known. And there was question about the book of Revelation, because although the book of Revelation says it's written by John, it doesn't say which John wrote it. And there were other Johns besides the apostle, and there were some who argued that the book of Revelation was not written by the apostle John. So they held it somewhat at arm's length from the canon. But you can see the one thing they were concerned about is authorship. They were concerned that the author of a book was really an apostle. And in probably about 22 or 23 of the book's cases, there was never any serious question. That's because when Paul wrote to the Corinthians, they received the letter from him, and they remembered who wrote it. It had his name right on it, by the way. Same thing with the Romans and others. You know, when Paul wrote letters to churches, they treasured them, they kept them. over the generations, they recopied them and kept them, you know, so that the early church had these authentic letters from these apostles, as well as the Gospels. And there was no reason ever to seriously question their authorship. Just a few books were open to question for a while.
Wasn't James also in question? I thought I had heard something about that at one time.
Yes. Some didn't want the book of James in there, but it was not held open to question in the same way as Jude was or Hebrews. Everybody knew that James was the brother of the Lord. I think they all knew that. I think they all agreed about that. And that he was the one that Paul actually referred to as an apostle in the book of Galatians. But he was not one of the 12 apostles. And, you know, there's always some question, what about these guys who aren't really part of the original apostolic band, you know, but are kind of on the, they're kind of connected to them in a secondary way. So there were differences of opinion, but I personally feel that the choices that ended up being made were pretty good.
Yes. Okay, very good. Thank you so much.
Okay, Jane. Thanks for your call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Ron calling from Pleasant Hill, California. Ron, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. So I have a question about judging. I was talking to a friend who has a friend that is involved in false religion, and I was basically saying he's deceived, and he was saying how I was judging his friend. And so that made me really consider, you know, judging. Am I really judging him? And so, you know, I went to the verse where it says, do not judge or you too will be judged with the same measure you judge others. And then I, you know, went to 1 Corinthians chapter 5 where it deals with the case of incest. And in verse 12 it says, what business is it is of mine to judge those outside the church? Are you not to judge those inside? And God will judge those outside, expel the wicked person from among you. So it seems to be like they're contradicting themselves. And you know, I've done some research.
No, let me clarify that now because we're going to run out of time real quick here. When Jesus said, judge not that you be not judged, he told us exactly in what sense he means. He says, don't try to get the speck out of your brother's eye when you have a beam in your own eye. He said, you'll be judged by the same standard as you use to judge others. And so, you know, we shouldn't be judging people for things that we are guilty of too. But Jesus said, do get the beam out of your own eye, and then you will be able to see clearly to get the speck out of your brother's eye. So it's entirely possible to be qualified to judge as long as you're not, you know, a hypocrite about it. And so Jesus is forbidding hypocritical judgment, that is, judging someone by a standard that would condemn you if it was turned back on you. That's what Jesus forbids. Elsewhere, Jesus says we should judge righteous judgment. And you pointed out 1 Corinthians. Many times in 1 Corinthians, Paul says we have to judge. Yeah, judging is a Christian activity, but some kind of judging is wrong. You were not wrong to say a person is deceived if they are deceived. That's not a wrong thing to say. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We're out of time. We are listener-supported. Go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and you can find out how to help us stay on the air. That's thenarrowpath.com. God bless you. Let's talk again tomorrow.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of KBRT, its ownership, its management, or its sponsors.
Your support of our teaching and talk programs helps change lives.
About 2 years ago, I ran into a young lady who was a few years younger than me, but she was really going through a hard time. She was really just drinking and struggling, but she was looking for something to anchor herself to.
Then she introduced her friend to Christian media.
She rededicated her life to the Lord. She is serving the Lord, and she's looking at going into college.
Stories like this happen every day. When you financially support our teaching and talk programs,
it was a great way for me to witness to her.
Tell your friends about AM 740, K-Bright.
We've launched what is essentially a whole new radio station to bring K-Bright to more parts of San Diego County. Will you help us get the word out? Please make it a point to tell your South County friends and family that K-Bright is available to more and more people in San Diego County on AM 740 and AM 1240.
The oldest and largest Christian radio voice in Southern California. 50,000 watt KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa and KNSN San Diego. Also on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled One Life, The Journey Continues. In her previous teaching, One Life, Joyce shared her personal testimony of pain and abuse that she faced growing up, and how God helped her through those hard times. That story has helped countless people face their own hardships. Now Joyce is back with One Life, The Journey Continues, to share what she has learned since that time in her personal walk with the Lord. She has collected some of the greatest lessons that she learned over the years and wants to share them with you today. But before she begins, we want to give you the opportunity to show the love of Christ with those who might feel forgotten. To find out what you can do, visit our website at joycemeyer.org/Christmas. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, One Life, The Journey Continues.
So I woke up thinking about myself. You know, whatever you think about early in the morning kind of gets you wound up for the day. And so I just had this little vision. It was God just put in my heart. He said, you know, you're like a little robot. You wake up in the morning and you start thinking about yourself and thinking about yourself. And he said, it's just like the devil comes and just winds you up, just gets you all wound up tight for the day, thinking about all this wrong stuff. And he said, then you put your feet on the floor, and the rest of the day, this is what you look like to me, a little robot that just goes around with one message. What about me? 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 Beep, beep. What about me? What about me? Amazing what God anoints. It's unbelievable.